The Nature Journal is brought to you by Sappi, the global specialized cellulose, paper and packaging company.
Well, hi from me, Tim Neary, with this week's edition of our Sappi Nature Journal in 60 Minutes. I always love the fact that listeners come in and ask me, can you find out about a book that Gus Mills has done, etc.? So we did one better than that. We had a chat to Gus about the book. And yes, it is still available. So if you are keen on the books of Gus Mills, who has got so much knowledge of the Kalahari and etc., please do listen to this. Then, of course, coming up towards Christmas, people want to know more about lenses and tripods. So I always feel sorry for my friends. I dragged Jacques Marchant in and we got an interview out of him. And then we'll end the program with Johan Marais. And of course, Johan is always good on his snakes. And this time he'll also talk a little bit about the rehabilitation of snakes. And I often wonder, just how easy is it to rehabilitate a snake? But settle yourselves down, sit back, grab a cup of coffee, and let's make the program happen. After all, it is the Nature Journal, and that's what we talk about.
Well, for once one sits rather in a pleasant part of the environment. We've got birds flying around the place, bit of a water in the background, and I think we're in the wrong place though, because I'm looking at a book that says Arid Kalahari. Gus, this is not the Arid Kalahari. Where on earth are we? Why are we looking at a different idea?
Well, we've forsaken the Kalahari and we've retired now and established ourselves in Mpumalanga, just outside Nelspruit, on the beautiful estate called the Tipperary Eco Estate, along a little river called the Tipperary River, and it's a great place to be.
Well, we are chatting to Dr. Gus Mills and his wife, Margie, about a new book that they're doing. Margie, there is one thing, though, that Gus said, which I don't believe. He said he's retired.
No, he's not getting a salary. That's basically what it means.
I like that comment, it's not getting a salary. I keep on asking Donnie van der Walt, X5050, have you got time? He says, I'm retired. Gus, first of all, what is the attraction to the Kalahari? Why do you keep going back there?
That's a difficult question. It's very different. It's an arid region. It's harsh, but it has so many different facets and faces to it. It can be absolutely beautiful. It can be forgiving. It can be cruel. It epitomizes nature, I think. And it's this vast area. It's pretty well, in today's world, untouched by modern humans as much as practically any other place in the world. And it's a system, I think, that I don't want to say it's simple. It's a lot easier to get into the Kalahari and to begin, we think, to understand it than it is some of the more complex, high rainfall areas with lots of different facets and so on. So for a scientist, for someone who's interested in trying to understand how ecosystems work and so on, Kalahari is just a magnificent place to start.
Kalahari Desert, there's nothing there, though. What's there to study? I mean, come on. It's sand. It's red sand, miles of it, sand dunes. There can't be any animals in it. I mean, you've got a lion on the front of your book. Surely not.
Well, you know, it contains five of the large carnivores in Africa, lion, leopard, cheetah, brown hyena, spotted hyena. The only one that's really absent is the wild dog. It's just outside the range, I think, of wild dogs. It's a little bit too arid for them. So what's interesting is that it is a system where all large carnivores can survive. And it also has wonderful nomadic ungulate populations, eland, red hartebeer, springbok, wildebeest. Then it's got resident species like the gemsbok and the steenbok. It's wonderful bird life. It has incredible raptors. Plants are fascinating. It's an arid system, but it's got lots of things going on in it.
Now, of course, when I started to do the interview, Margie said that just you and Gus, and Gus said, not a chance. He didn't know what he was opening himself up for. Margie, looking at the book, I love it when I see Gus and Margie Mills on the bottom. If it was our household, I'd be told, you write, I'm doing the photographs. That would be the end of the discussion. Otherwise, it'd be a war. Quite a few wars go on for a book like this, or is it a case of, no, he's the scientist, you'll do the writing, etc.? How do you separate out who does what?
Well, Gus is the scientist. I have a degree in zoology, so I have interests, but I'm not quite as driven as my husband. So I must admit, he's the writer, really. I'm the supporter. I'm always there. I help as much as I can. I do a bit of writing, but it's always been easy. No, we haven't had too much conflict getting these things done.
Gus, I think you must have paid for that one. Now, a natural history guide to the arid Kalahari, including Galahadi Frontier Park. Now, this obviously is an area that is really close to you. It's an area that you smile when you talk about, and you did mention you love telling people from work in the Kruger that the Kruger National Park is the second best place on earth.
Yeah, I mean, I've been incredibly fortunate, I think, in my life. I've been able to work in probably the two most iconic conservation areas in Southern Africa and arguably in Africa, Kruger Park and Kalahari. So we spent 12 years when we started off on our career studying hyenas mainly in the Kalahari. Then we went to Kruger for 22 years where I was able to continue my interest in large carnivores, studying lions and cheetahs and hyenas and wild dogs. But I always had a hankering to go back to the Kalahari. And so in 2006, I was fortunate enough to be able to go back, and we spent 6 very happy years there doing a cheetah study.
Is that what has led you to the book? Is it a book around cheetah, or is it a book that covers the whole reserve and the whole area?
Many years ago, Clem Hagner, who was a well-known photographer, Clem was a great Kalahari lover, and we spent a lot of time there. And we produced a guidebook to the Kalahari Gemsbok Park, as it was then. And that book went out of print, and for many years there was no really detailed account of the natural history of the Kalahari. And so this is really a revision, an extensive revision of that original book. And what we try to do here, it's very much a guide to the natural history. We've recounted our experiences with the fauna and flora in the area, trying to help make the visit to the park much more interesting. They can read about what they see and the background to it. We've also been fortunate enough to be able to illustrate it with a lot of photographs that we've taken while we've been working there.
Margie, looking at the photos in there, are these photographs something that you look at time and time again and think, hang on a minute, close eyes, mind goes back to the moment?
Yes, definitely. I think we're always dropping cheetah names and animal names from our studies there. And certainly when we drive there, we're always saying, oh, that's where that happened and that's where this happened. So it is a continuous memory recall and looking at new things too. So
the fact that you've spent such a long time there, is it a place where you can say nothing more to learn, don't need to go back, or is there a drawback again?
Oh, definitely not, no. As far as the nothing to learn is concerned, oh, we just scratched the surface after 18 years of living there. And I think the more you start looking at an animal, the more questions you have to ask and to get answered. No, one will never fully understand what's going on there, but you try and scratch the surface and start seeing patterns and that sort of thing.
Gus, you see what happens while we're standing here. We have a little bushbuck who's walking on the opposite side. I don't suppose you could whip up a cheetah and just drop it in there as well, could you? Not possible? No. But this is one of the things when you sit in a genuine eco state, this eco state that we're sitting in, as Guy said, it is a stunning piece of heaven. And there are just tall trees around us. There is just an open area, water flowing at the bottom. And I've got to get in a motor car and drive back to Joburg. Not looking forward to the second part. Gus, going back to this, the learning, the continuous learning. Where does one stop the continuous learning, or don't we? Is this book just somewhere that even for you, with all your experience on cheetah, wild dog, hyena, is there more to discover?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, as Margie said, you know, the more you study, the more you look at things, the more questions you ask. And I mean, that's science, and that's what happens. And this is a continuous process. And the small contribution we've made will hopefully be taken up by other people who will continue. Yeah, it's a never-ending process of learning and understanding. And of course, ecosystems are very dynamic, I think, and changes. And animals adapt. So you can never really say this is what they do and this is how they behave, because they're continually reacting and responding to whatever nature throws up at them.
I kind of always get the feeling is that the animals don't read the books. Every time I read a book on behavioral patterns, somebody has forgotten to show it to the creatures. Looking at this book, what is one of the areas that is in your mind that is a place that has a special part of it? Is there a particular photograph? Is there a section that you've written? Something that you can turn around and say, that typifies what I enjoy?
Well, obviously the book has a bias towards the larger carnivores, because this is what I've really been interested in. There's a whole chapter on the hyenas, and they are very, very close to our heart because those are the first animals we studied. They are such incredibly interesting animals and still, unfortunately, fairly maligned by people. People don't really appreciate the animals for what they are. So that is certainly an important part. And then the bits on cheetahs, because we've managed to find out a few new things about cheetahs and how well they're adapted to arid regions. And so we've gone into quite a bit of detail about them. Those are perhaps two aspects that are interesting. And, you know, there's so many things. The birds, the continual changes in birds, and the fact that you always going to find some slightly different or unusual bird in the Kalahari. I mean, perhaps one of the most amazing birds we saw there was a buff-spotted flufftail. Now, where on earth did that come from? And the chapter on birds is called Birds Can Fly. And the idea is that I believe that wherever you stay in South Africa, if you stay there long enough, every single bird in the book will at some time or other pass that place because they can fly and they're very mobile. And this is what happens.
Scientists generally are quite cold. An animal is given a number and there is no association, no recognition. There are boxes to tick off, etc. Is that true? Or are you quite like everybody else? The cheetah gets a name, it might look like Fred, or there are amusing times where you think to yourself, animals have got senses of humor.
Not all individuals are the same, that's for sure. I think we do tend to perhaps not give enough credence to the fact that animals do behave differently and different animals have different, if you like, personalities. You know, the thing that really turns me on and that I just so enjoy is being able to observe these animals behaving in whatever way they are. And a lot of the time, it's not pretty, you know, to see two cheetah males killing each other or one male killing another cheetah. You know, some people might be turned off by that. But to me, it's fascinating and it's interesting. And that's the way it is. So emotions, yes, it just gives me personally so much pleasure just to be able to watch these animals. But I accept whatever happens. I don't get sad if the cubs get killed. Margie gets sadder than I do about that because that's what happens. And I just find it wonderful to be able to, and interesting and important, to be able to observe these things and try to understand them and to document them.
Well, effectively, you can't have nature as this wonderful dog lying at your feet, can you? Nature's cruel in its worst and yet beautiful at the same time.
Absolutely. You know, it's a survival of the fittest. It's a whole process. Out of death comes life, and I think that's very important. You can't have life without death. And yes, we must appreciate it. We don't put any value judgments on it. It's a wonderful system. I think if humans could emulate nature a bit better, things might be a bit better in this world.
Well, of course, this is one person who would happily go and emulate it living in the Kalahari. Margie, the ease of living in the Kalahari, is it an easy place to live? What are some of the fun bits that you can think about?
Yeah, it was certainly challenging at times. When we first went there in the 70s, we were very isolated, lived up in Nossop Camp. No telephone, just a little generator at night, and difficult to make contact. And especially when we had children there, that really became difficult, especially when they were sick. But one uses your sort of instincts there when you have to, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. Also, getting fresh food was difficult. We did live a lot on tinned food initially, but now our second stay now, we were based in the southern camp, Tuiriferin, and we were only 260 kilometers away from our nearest fresh tomato, so that was quite cool. And we lived very well. We camped a lot, staying with the cheetah. We had a roof tent on our Land Cruiser, and so we would go out for a week at a time, sometimes 2 weeks, it depended what we were doing. And just when the cheetah slept, then we'd sleep, and that's how we went. It was an incredible experience. And I must admit, there were times when I wondered what I was doing when it was 40 degrees and the cheetah were just sleeping and we were sitting out there with no shade and trying to keep ourselves amused and awake in case the cheetahs decided to do something. But it was all the most amazing experience, and we have been so blessed to be able to do what we've done.
Just listening to what Margie was saying there, this is more than a labor of love that you've undertaken. And I would imagine there must be times when you're writing up your book and thinking to yourself, did I do that?
When I go back to when we first went to the Kalahari as students, going to spend 2 years studying the brown hyena. I don't think in my wildest dreams I thought that what a wonderful and interesting life I was going to have, you know, what incredible things I was going to be able to observe. So, yeah, it's almost like a dream, really. It's just been wonderful.
Well, a dream it might be, or like a dream, but you can live this dream for a while, and you can pick yourselves up a copy of the Natural History Guide to the Arid Kalahari, including the Kalahari Transfrontier Park. Look for the book. It is by Gus and Margie Mills. It has got the most stunning photographs in it, and the text as well is going to be something that you will enjoy. It is a guidebook that I think you can pick up and you can read every night, a chapter or two, as you're enjoying a glass of wine, your whiskey, or a cup of tea. It's also one that you can take with you when you head off into the great outdoors. Look at the back cover. You'll see pictures of Gus and Margie, but even more so, you're also going to pick up that red sand. And my belief is that red sand enters your bloodstream, and once it's there, you don't get rid of it. And I think it is an absolutely stunning book to have. And of course, we will give you details at the end of the program as to exactly where you can get the book, how you can get the book, and it'll be a great one to have. Gus, it's just one, as I say, every time I look at this, I marvel at the work that you've done over the years and the collection of your books that sit on my shelf. Hyenas, thoroughly enjoyable, and hopefully people have added that to their bookshelf as well.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. It's been lovely to be able to speak to you, and we just hope that people will get some enjoyment. If they get 10% of the enjoyment out of our book, as we've had out of the Kalahari, it'll be worthwhile.
Well, I would imagine, Margie, not even 10% of the sand is something that you'll be able to get out of your own mind on this book.
No, it'll always be in us, this sand. Yeah, it certainly captivates you.
And that was Dr. Gus Mills and his wife, Margie. And of course, they have written the book, Arid Kalahari. Have a look for the book on the bookshelf, and as I said, at the end of the program, I will give you the contact details of exactly how you can get this book. Makes a wonderful present for people in South Africa and beyond, and also for anybody that goes to the Kalahari Transfrontier Park. If you don't have this book, well, you're missing a big part of your journey. Well, Margie and Gus have a number of books available that you can purchase directly from them, and their contact details are mills.gus, that's mills.gus@gmail.com. They'll be only too happy to assist you.
SAPI, a leading global specialized cellulose, paper and packaging company, is committed to sustainability by trading more lightly on the planet, supporting the development of neighboring communities and providing customers with quality products. SAPI protects biodiversity by conserving one-third of its land to protect wetlands, rivers and indigenous plants and bush, home to over 400 bird species and 50 red data species. For more information, visit www.sapi.com. SAPI, inspired by life.
Well, of course, it's coming up to Christmas time, and I guess one of the things is I'd like to give myself some presents. photography we speak about fairly often. Photography, always an interesting subject. But we do have Jacques with us, and Jacques is from Digital Experience. We're going to talk about a couple of items that maybe you'd like to buy yourself for Christmas. Jacques, welcome to you, and no doubt Father Christmas, somebody you enjoy in the shop.
Certainly, this time of year, he's good for business.
Let's have a look. We're going to go out and we're going to decide we're going to buy ourselves a camera and we're going to buy a lens. I'm going to buy a Nikon D4 or whatever it is, and oh dear, I've got no money for a lens. Is that the right way to do it?
Not at all, Timothy. In fact, the exact opposite is the best way of doing it. Your lens is your image-forming device. Camera, in the meaning of the word camera, is merely a chamber. It's a light-proof chamber that records data. The lens is the be-all and end-all in photography.
When you say the lens is the be-all, end-all, there are all sorts of numbers on lenses. And this is where somebody like a mere mortal gets really confused. And somebody talks about f-stops on a lens. They talk about a fixed focal lens and all sorts of things. And no, but that's a 400 lens and it's not a zoom lens. Where do we start? What is the first question we ask about a lens?
Something we've spoken about before. What kind of photographs do you want to take? I know your particular interest is in game and wildlife, but there's portraits, there's landscapes, there's reportage photography, and the ubiquitous smartphone. The reportage we've seen from the troubles in Syria and the troubles in Egypt being broadcast worldwide, made using video-capable cell phones. That's not the speciality of the Digital Experience. Ours, of course, is separate cameras, lenses, in current terms, even all-in-one camera lens combination with huge zooms, meaning you don't have to carry large luggage full of expensive photographic kit. The range, the variety is vast. Once you've established what kind of style of photography you want to do, you can then start looking at the first and most important number on a lens is the focal length. Generally, most of us have the so-called part frame or DX frame camera, or APS-C to give it its technical term. That, for long tele lenses, for game and wildlife, possibly for sport, for paparazzi type photography, is awesome because there is an apparent focal length increase. Focal length is a predetermined number. The how we use the focal length changes depending on what camera we put it on. Generally for wildlife, we look at telephoto lenses. If you're in the position to be in a non-public reserve and you can get somewhat closer to the animals, a 200 or 300 millimeter is generally sufficient. If we go to the public parks where access is limited to tarred and dirt roads, then generally we would want to look at longer focal lengths, quite normally up to as high as a 500 millimeter. Now, if we use a 500 millimeter on the APS-C sensored cameras, in other words, your entry to mid-level SLR cameras, the appearance is that of a 750 millimeter lens because we use 50% less of the image circle. This is not an actual focal length growth. This is an apparent focal length growth. Then, and as critical as focal length, is the so-called F number or aperture. The aperture is a ratio of the focal length, which is a mathematically predetermined number, to the physical diameter of the lens. In other words, how much of the available light are we able to vacuum up? Or with game and wildlife, early morning, late afternoon, how much of the available darkness are we able to vacuum up? With the decrease in the F number, so a small F number represents a large lens opening. This controls the amount of light and, again, in terms of wildlife, critically, the depth of field. In other words, the area in your photograph from front to back that is in focus. Animals are the color they are to enable them to disguise themselves from either predators, or predators to disguise themselves from prey. So a lot of the photographs we will take of wildlife, it's difficult to distinguish the water buck from the bush in the background. And therefore, the preference is for a small aperture number in other words, a large lens opening. These lenses, however, can be horrifyingly expensive. So for most of us, it's a compromise, what we would like versus what the wallet can bear.
Yep, we've always got that compromise, haven't we?
Absolutely.
Well, we're chatting to Jacques Marchant. Jacques is from Digital Experience, and of course, he is our regular contributor, talking about photographic issues, and today about lenses.
Jacques, here we're talking about a lens, for example. Let's stay with the 300.
Yes.
And I see a lens that says a 70 to 300. And then the next lens in the box next that says it's a 300 only. What is the difference between those two lenses?
The 70 to 300 would be a zoom telephoto lens, generally. The other is a fixed focal length. The fixed focal length generally giving you superior optical and therefore picture performance, but also coming with a matching cost. The prime, as they are called, focal lengths are generally manufactured in faster apertures. They're big, bulky, and expensive. But if you're looking for the ultimate in optical performance, that is the way to go. We've gotten a little lazy since Voigtlander's invention of the zoom lens about 60 years ago, in that we now expect lenses to be zoom lenses. This is all well and good, except that generally the optical performance of a zoom lens is not quite as superior as that of a prime lens.
With these two different lenses again, and if I think of my own bag, I have a very old Sigma lens, and when you crank it, it starts to look like Pinocchio's nose. Now, Claire has a more modern Nikkor lens, and it's all inside. Is there a vast difference then between the lens where both of them being telephoto lenses, both of them I think are 70 to 300s, but they seem to be two different constructions? Does that affect the lens at all?
The internal zoom and internal focus lenses, as we've come to know them, generally are later optical, more recent optical computations. That's in itself not to say that an older lens I have in my bag, a lens from 1957, that they are bad, the older lenses. They are just different. With the speed at which computers can generate calculations, the opticians can do many different and many more calculations with the computer aiding them than they could previously. With modern machining techniques, we can also make lenses to much tighter tolerances than they could previously. An internal zoom is generally somewhat more complex to both design and manufacture. You will find, therefore, that in a lot of cases, in zoom lenses, internal focus and internal zoom actions are a little more expensive than older designs. A lot of the older designs can coexist with the more modern designs, and it's not to say they're automatically inferior performers. The cost convenience is traded for functional differences on some of the Canon zoom lenses. There are push-pull actions on the majority of zoom lenses as we know them. The twist action will extend or retract the actual lens barrel depending on your specific zoom setting. That's inconvenient if you're attempting to balance the lens on a gimbal mount because you change where the center point is and may not be able to let go of a camera, where with an internal zoom lens you can generally set a zero point on the gimbal, zoom, let go of the camera, and the camera will return to its zero point without being touched. This is for those of you that want to try and use a gimbal out of the window of a car, for instance.
We're chatting to Jacques Marchant. Jacques is from Digital Experience, one of our regular contributors and sponsors of the program. And of course, Jacques is talking to us about camera lenses. What do we know about camera lenses? In fact, how do we choose them? The other item that I've noticed in a bag so often is a converter. What do we mean when we're saying, okay, there's this little black thing that you can put onto the back of the lens and clip it into the camera and it says, I'm a 1.4 converter. Why do we have those? What do those do?
The optical tricks, for want of a better description, that allow us to carry two smaller devices that give us the function of a third larger device. There are optical implications in using converters. They generally will only fit and work on faster aperture lenses. The problem with a converter 1.4, as you quoted, the cost is one stop of exposure. That's okay as long as the final sum, because in putting a 1.4 converter on, we multiply the maximum focal length by 1.4, and we also multiply the minimum aperture by 1.4. Meaning if you're attempting to use a 1.4 converter on an f5.6 lens, the camera may struggle to autofocus. There are a number of cameras that will not autofocus at f8. However, on f2.8, f4 aperture lenses, we can use on an f2.8 generally a 2x converter, and on an f4 lens generally a 1.4x converter. It's a relatively inexpensive way of having more lenses in your bag.
And as you say, there is always, to all these things, there is a cost. There's a cost to the photography at the end.
Ultimately, any converter will multiply the inherent faults in a lens by the factor printed on the side of the converter. Generally, lenses are made within, let's say, a 2-3% parameter. The problem is now that if we put a lens that's at one or other of the 3% extremes, we multiply the errors in the lens by the factor of the converter. Yes, the converter will come generally at a cost in picture quality as well. However, if you are traveling and you're attempting to travel light, a converter is a way, like I said, of having more lenses in the bag without the bag weighing that much more.
We're chatting lenses with Jacques Marchant. And of course, Jacques is from Digital Experience, who are sponsors on the program. So often people take out these lenses and they look like howitzers and they're quite scary things at the best of times. And it has fascinated me during our discussion on the bridge cameras, just what the bridge camera can achieve. But I would imagine the beauty and availability where you can have a lens that does portraiture, does your landscapes, it does your wildlife, in the back garden even, I would imagine, for bird photography. You're going to have a lot of fun when you can start to change your lenses. The one question that comes up I've heard is wide angle, and the other one is fisheye. When we talk about an extreme wide-angle lens, what do we mean by that?
Generally, a standard, the so-called standard lens, is relative to the view of one human eye. It's approximately 46 degrees on the diagonal. As we go wider on the acceptance angle of a lens, we get more and more picture in, the cost generally being in distortion, that parallel lines will no longer remain parallel. However, if you're wanting to do the vast plains of Africa, a wide-angle lens as near to the ground as you can get it gives you a very good idea of the spaces of Africa. A fisheye takes this to the extreme. A true fisheye will generate a semicircular image in the middle of the photographic rectangle, and it will give you 180 degrees of view on all axes of the compass. So you're able to see essentially everything that's in front of the lens.
I.e., you're a fish looking at what's out there through the water.
That's where it comes from, yes.
The last one that comes to my mind is that word macro. The people that rush around, bums up, heads down on the ground, taking photographs of small bugs, beetles, and miniature flowers. What do we mean by a macro lens? And in fact, is it a standalone lens, or does every lens have that capability?
Right. Answering your questions in reverse order, no, every lens does not have macro capabilities. Generally, they are quite specialist purpose lenses. The accepted ratio is a macro lens should give you an image 1/2 life size. That means that if your object is 50 millimeters in life, the image inside your camera before you put it on a computer screen or print it, the image is 1/2 of that, which is 25 millimeters. The good lenses will run at 1:1 and better. Canon make a very beautiful specialist purpose lens that will give you an image 5x life size in camera. These come with a matching cost.
Like all these things, as you say, I always love your word, the matching cost. And again, I would imagine that some of the old lenses, which you also mentioned, there's nothing wrong with them. You just might have to operate them manually.
Very much so. A number of the new generation mirrorless interchangeable lens cameras can be adapted and have been successfully adapted to take lenses that were made 50, 60, 80, over 100 years. Somebody in America remanufactured his whole Canon EOS 5 camera to take 105-year-old, I believe, French-sourced lens.
On the subject, and you mentioned Canon lens, and I mentioned earlier Sigma lens, etc., is it important with your camera to maintain the body make and the lens? Should they be matched continuously?
Yes, first prize is to match a Nikon lens to a Nikon camera, a Sony lens to a Sony camera, Leica lens to a Leica camera. But all of these generally, because the original equipment manufacturer is making for a single brand and the third-party lens manufacturers, in this case Sigma, Tamron, Tokina, to mention but a few, are designing a lens that can be used on as many as 6 different cameras. No one lens, but they will manufacture a lens in 5 or 6 different versions depending on which cameras they have chosen to manufacture this lens for.
So, as you say, if you can, always go for the same make as the body of the camera, and that will give you a lot more enjoyment at the end of the day, because I guess that's what it really is, isn't it? The lens is giving you enjoyment, let alone anything else.
Absolutely, and then of course there are a smaller percentage of the buying population that require these to make a living, but for most of us it's about fun, enjoyment, be it for putting a screensaver on your computer, be it for posting on one of the numerous photographic sites, Flickr, Instagram, Tumblr, to mention again but a few, or to enter pictures in your camera club competition, or to make large prints to frame and hang in your lounge. The lens is the thing that ultimately will be the image-forming device. We can go as simple as drilling a small hole in a body cap, coating it with kitchen foil and pricking a pin through it, as the original camera obscura people did. It is capable of generating an image. It is therefore a lens. The image is challenging to get, but it is a lens nonetheless. To top-of-the-line optics from the Japanese and the Germans costing in the hundreds of thousands of rand. Specialist low-light application, specialist sub macro, in other words, we work at near microscopic enlargements, 200 and 300 times enlargements. It really depends on what it is you need to do.
The importance when coming in to buy a lens from you of bringing your camera body, is that a good idea?
Cannot be overstated, because then you have images you can take away with modern digital photography, images you can take away and peruse at your leisure on your computer, and use your own mind to make your decision. I can assist, the sales staff at the Digital Experience can assist, but to bring a camera in makes it easy for everybody.
We're chatting to Jacques Marchant, and Jacques, of course, is from Digital Experience. He is our camera boff and always gives us great advice. Jacques, the tripod. How do we go about choosing a tripod? What is the difference between a tripod and a monopod? I think those are the two things for the day.
Tripod is a fairly simple device. 3 legs that support your camera, your flash gun, your lighting system, your binoculars, your telescope. It really, Timothy, is a brute force engineering device. If it is too light in its construction, it's not going to hold whatever it is steady. With lighting, that's not that critical. With a camera, either with a long lens or a camera doing a long exposure, star trails at night, if the thing moves, it's not doing its job. A very well-known American photographic writer, Tom Hogan, wrote a very beautiful article on his blog that says, in American terms, you can spend $1,000 on a tripod, or you can spend $1,700 to do the same thing. As you said, buying a tripod, oh, this is cheap and it should be good enough. No, it won't be. Don't skimp on a tripod. You can buy lightweight tripods that are strongly enough engineered these days with modern materials, magnesiums, and the flavor of the moment, carbon fiber tripods. There are some very beautifully engineered tripods from the Italians, and most recently again from the British. three-legged thing make a very beautiful range of tripods that fold up really small. They're lightweight, being a number of them being constructed out of carbon fiber. However, they are not inexpensive. Quality in engineering costs money. A monopod is, again, what it says, a single leg. Very useful if you're attempting to perhaps take photographs from a game viewing vehicle in a sports stadium. It gives you the support straight down, let Mother Earth do the work for your lens without generally having the mass or inconvenience of a tripod. If you watch sport broadcasts at all, quite often when the TV camera pans around the edge of a cricket field, soccer field, rugby field, whatever, you will see the commercial photographers sitting there with these huge lenses on a single leg because it allows him to pick up and move quickly, but when he puts it down, or she puts it down, there is still support underneath the lens, so we don't have to worry too much about vibration, people vibration, camera vibration. We don't have to worry as much about that as if we're attempting to handhold the device. But yeah, buy a quality tripod or monopod. They last longer, they function, but they don't come cheap.
Well, my comment to that, Jacques, is quite simple. Anybody comes into the shop and wants a cheap tripod, please send them to my house. I have got literally dozens lying around here, all broken, or with some or other piece missing, and I can assure you, we've got a couple of heavy old beasts, and those are the ones that we rely on, and they do a wonderful job. You've heard what Jacques has said. A good tripod, you cannot beat it. A good camera body, but a better lens, you cannot beat it. And I think that is the most important thing. And of course, when you go into Digital Experience to go and buy your lens, make sure you take your camera body with you. And it might just be down to the fact that when the guys look at it, they might point out something about your camera body. It might be old and tired, and in fact is, one of the problems could be your camera body, which is why you're not getting the pictures that you think you should be getting. So it's always great as well. Go in and talk to the guys, get their information, get their experience, and of course, use that experience. It does make your photography a lot more fun. I personally can't understand why people spend a lot of money on cameras and then leave them in the wardrobe because they don't use them. It's far easier, even if it's your back garden, taking pics of your child, taking pics of your own motor car, but get out there and use that camera. That's what it was designed for, and it's there for your pleasure, and at the end of the day, you can share that pleasure with a lot of others. Jacques, I do know that you guys have also got that wonderful new Leica boutique inside, and just having walked in there and had a look at it, I can assure you folks, I just drooled, and it wasn't only my wacky lip that was causing me to drool. I would love to get my hands on some of that equipment. It's just really poetry in motion, isn't it?
Leica is truly special, and it's a great honor to operate the first Leica boutique in Africa. Yeah, they're special. Not necessarily for every wallet or photographer, but they are very, very, very well-engineered pieces of equipment.
Jacques, on that, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you again, Timothy.
And that was Jacques Marchand. Jacques is from Digital Experience. Walk into Digital Experience, you will find a completely different frame of mind of the way the shop is operated, the specialists that they have inside there, the different products that they have, all in their special areas. And you can go in and come out having made an informed decision about how you're going to spend your money. And of course, you can go in and drool. And that is the most important part, because once you start drooling, you will go back eventually and buy. And it's all the way from TV screens to every bit of photographic equipment that you can think of. Well, of course, sitting with Johan Maree, finding out more about snakes. And I think today we're going to ask Johan about snake courses and maybe also a little bit of information on rehabilitating snakes. Does it work when you take a snake from one area as well? I think you're doing it a great service, pop it into a cooler box, move it 4 or 5 kilometers down the road, toss it out. Or is it like my theory with leopards, where it's a particularly bad thing to do because the snake doesn't know where it is? But I think let's start off, first of all, Johan, and find out about snake courses. What sort of courses are available and what do you do in your courses on snakes?
Tim, most of my courses are for corporate clients. So I'm doing a lot of training all over Africa. Mines have enormous problems because they're usually in the middle of nowhere, and there's a lot of snakes coming onto the premises and people having a lot of encounters with snakes. In South Africa, I try and do at least one course a month here in Gauteng. I also do courses in Cape Town, Durban, and up in the Shishlui area in Zululand. And my most popular course is a one-day course that is split into two sections. The morning session, which a lot of people attend in isolation, is snake awareness. And what I do in that three-hour course is I tell people a lot more about the biology and behavior of snakes. We look at identification and spend a lot of time on first aid treatment and the medical treatment of snake bite. It's a 3-hour course, and after that, they write a test. My course is FAGASA endorsed, and successful candidates then get themselves a certificate in snake awareness and first aid and snake bite. After the lunch break, we then do snake handling. That is the afternoon portion of the course. And what that is aimed at is to equip people with the correct skills to deal with the removal of any snake, be it dangerous or not, in any emergency situation. So using snake hooks, tongs, buckets, and snake tubes, I teach people how to catch a snake, get it into a container, and remove it from the premises for it to be released elsewhere. There's no physical handling. We don't grab snakes behind the head or pick them up by the tail. There's a lot of emphasis on safety in these courses.
Now, I like the idea where you're saying you don't handle the snake, because I'm always of the belief that people that handle snakes are going to get bitten somewhere down the line, and it just seems to be inevitable. And of course, I suppose somebody's going to remove a snake. It's not an everyday occurrence, and you need to know how to do it. But of course, there's that safety involved.
Yes, a lot of people might just encounter 1 or 2 or 3 snakes a year. So you might do a course, and 6 months later, you come across the first snake. And it could be a difficult situation. It could be under a desk, tangled in computer wires, really awkward spot. What I also find is that a lot of the guys that come in the courses, the first thing they want to do is handle black mambas. And I don't use black mambas in the courses. The reason for that is that the black mamba is a very dangerous snake. It's not an aggressive snake. That's a myth. They're very nervous. They're very dangerous. They're very long. An average mamba is easily 3 meters in length. And it's not the sort of snake you want to tamper with easily. From a game lodge perspective, it's also a snake that is very seldom encountered. It's not the type of snake that you often find in a lodge or so. And some of the lodges that I work for in the last 30 years, they've had maybe 2 black mambas within their lodges. So no handling, no hands-on, none of this sort of ego stuff, because that's when guys do get bitten, when they want to start getting brave and clever. And not just is it very dangerous to grab a snake behind the head, it's very traumatic for the animal, so it's just not necessary.
With the courses and snake identification, think of the puff adder. Coming from the Eastern Cape, our puff adders look very different to the puff adders I've met in Gauteng, and even more different to the puff adders that I've met in the Kalahari. How do these guys get so many different sets of clothing? Is it the same puff adder? And I suppose that the question I'm going to say is, how easy is it to identify a snake and say, that one over there is venomous?
Now, that's pretty difficult. In Southern Africa, we're dealing with close to 170 different species and subspecies of snakes. And in some of them, like the Cape Cobra or the mole snake, you could have 5 or 6 or 7 different color varieties. Even in the same area, you could have more than one color variety. So the colors aren't always habitat linked, although that often is the case. So in horn adders, for instance, in the red Kalahari sand, they tend to be far more red, whereas the ones in Namibia and the white sand are a lot lighter. But then you get a bright yellow Cape Cobra in the middle of the Trans-Kalahari National Park, and you say, what's the deal? You can see it from a kilometer away. So it's very difficult to identify snakes by looking at colors, and you have to start looking at a few other things. You also need to try and get to know the 5 or 6 common snakes in your area. Every area that you're in is only going to have a small number of snakes that are often encountered. And if you can get to know those few snakes, you make life a lot easier. But identification is not easy, and you know, certainly not as difficult as birds, but they're hard. Puff adders are easy, even though it varies from very, very dark to very light or in between. The body shape is quite unique, and they're not that difficult to tell apart. But when you start looking at little gray snakes and little brown snakes, it can become very difficult, and experienced snake handlers often make mistakes.
Is it a good policy then to virtually take the view of saying, okay, guy, you're a snake, you could be potentially dangerous, I'm going to leave you alone and I'm going to walk away, or else I'm going to have attended the course, terribly sorry you are in the kitchen, I do need to ask you to leave in the appropriate snake bucket or whatever you have taught somebody to do.
Yes, I think that's very important. People should never be complacent when it comes to dealing with snakes. For some reason, people often come across small snakes and regard them as not dangerous, whereas obviously babies from venomous parents are as venomous as the adults. They might not have the same amount of venom, but a small cobra or a small mamba has more than enough venom to kill you. And I come across a lot of people that get bitten by small snakes because they think they're harmless. Be careful. Don't tamper with snakes. I have a lot of people send me a photograph of a snake in their hand and ask me what snake it is. And that is just dumb. You know, you shouldn't be picking up snakes and trying to work out afterwards what it is.
Crazy. I wouldn't have thought people do that sort of thing. Mind you, we are talking about some of the strange things that people get up to. Johan, also though, we get to that occasion of snake has been knocked over on the road. Somebody sees the snake and it's got a crushed jaw, whatever. They get out, pick it up to put it on the side of the road. Is that a wise move to do, or should you just simply leave this alone? Unfortunately, it has been crushed. Don't endanger yourself as well.
Any snake that is driven over on a tar road is going to die, or likelihood, because they have a long, thin vertebrae, they have lots of little ribs, and a tire going over a snake will break that and effectively kill the snake. It might not die immediately, but it's certainly going to die. It's a bad idea to want to pick up one of those snakes. They're already in agony. They're in pain. There's a good chance that it could turn around and bite you. And we've had a few interesting cases in recent years where people have picked up injured snakes in the roads and ended up in ICU from a snake bite. So those snakes are going to die. Don't tamper with them. You know, don't try and pick them up. If you can drag them off the road with a long stick or something and it's going to make you feel better, that's fine. But don't take a chance.
And of course, you also stand a pretty good chance of getting knocked over by the next motorist going past. Now, the next question, though, is we've seen that snake in the bottom of the garden. We've managed to use the equipment you have taught us to use. We put it into the box. We drive 5 kilometers down the road and we toss it out. First thing, is it going to come back again? Does it have a homing instinct? And second of all, have we done that snake a favor?
Tim, we don't have good evidence that snakes will come home from far away. And in a lot of instances where people remove a snake and see the snake a few days later, it's not the same snake. Some research has been done where snakes have been microchipped or radio transmitters put in them. And yes, we know some cases where snakes have returned from a fair distance. Snakes will often have a favorite hangout. They might live down the same hole for years, feed around there, bask around there. But by and large, the majority of snakes are removed a kilometer or two or more away from where they're captured will not return to that area. That's a bit of a myth. As for how much good you're doing, I think it's far better to get a snake in a bucket and drive a few kilometers down the road and release it than chopping its head off. But having said that, there is a likelihood that a large portion of snakes that are relocated don't make it. It takes them a long, long time to become established in an area where they have sufficient food, a good place to hide, where they are well camouflaged and not that exposed to predators. So if you're going to take a puffer a few kilometers down the road, it's going to have to, again, spend a lot of time finding a new home. And all of that time while it's moving, it's exposed to predators. And at the same time, it might be competing with snakes that are there already, because every area has a carrying capacity. You can have so many puffers in an area. And if there was room for more puffers, you'd have more surviving. You know, that's very debatable. It's something that we need to research better. But I think one of the important things is don't take a snake very far away from where you find it. You know, 5 or 10 kilometers is fine. But you can start interfering with genetic purity if you pick up puffers in Durban and bring them back and let them go here in Gauteng. That's not a good idea.
Snakes as pets. How good of a pet does a snake make? Does it respond to voice? Are they like our normal household dog that learns commands, etc.?
I guess I'm not the ideal person to ask because I lack that collecting gene. I think that snakes make ideal captive animals in the sense that they are easy to maintain. You can feed a snake every second or third week. They don't mess a lot. You can do beautiful displays with natural vegetation that look really good. And they're not very demanding. Provided they have water, they're kept in the right conditions, they really do exceptionally well. One of the measures of captive animals is always whether they breed or not. And snakes breed incredibly well in captivity. It's a big industry. There are thousands and thousands of people in Gauteng that keep snakes. It's a very popular pastime, and I have no problem with snakes in captivity. I really think that they make very good display animals. No, they don't respond to you. They don't really recognize you. A lot of people think their snakes recognize them. Snakes don't have ears, they can't hear, but they do adjust well to captivity, and some harmless snakes like corn snakes that are handled quite often just well to being handled. They seldom bite. The danger is that there are far too many people keeping deadly exotic snakes. We have between 80 and 100 species of deadly exotic snakes in captivity in this country. Probably thousands and thousands of them. I have no idea how many, but my guess would be that Gauteng will have 4,000 or 5,000 deadly exotic snakes. And a lot of these keepers are youngsters. They're 16, 17 years old. They're keeping king cobras, rattlesnakes, taipans, and very few of these keepers have antivenom. And that's bad news because a lot of exotic snakes are escaping, a lot of them being caught in people's gardens. I regularly catch exotic snakes on calls. And if these exotic snakes start escaping, someone's going to get bitten. And with the lack of antivenom, it could cause a human death.
And I would imagine also with a lack of knowledge, if you've got something strange in your garden, which you might just think is a visiting mole snake, and it might just not be.
That really is a big problem. And, you know, some of these snakes like Western Diamondback rattlesnakes, you can buy a youngster for probably 200 or 300 rand. And there are pet shops all over the place selling them. There are no real regulations in most of the provinces. Certainly here in Gauteng, any exotic snake that is here, you can purchase with no permit, no regulation, no experience. So you could effectively go out today and buy yourself 5-meter king cobra if you have the right amount of money.
And can you go out and buy yourself a puff adder for the same sort of money? Are we allowed to keep our own indigenous snakes?
Not without a permit. So the keeping of indigenous snakes is quite strictly regulated in most of the provinces. At this stage in KwaZulu-Natal, you can keep most but not all of the indigenous snakes without a permit. So that's a bit of a tough one. So invariably what happens is if you want an indigenous one, you're going to have to purchase something that's captive bred. And these strict laws affecting the keeping of indigenous snakes have been largely responsible for this massive growth in exotic snakes. You can't easily import something from overseas because you need quarantine facilities and you need to abide by many laws. But if you smuggle something here, once it's here, it's fine. There's nothing that regulates it.
And we do know that South Africa is a really law-abiding country when it comes to most things that are conservation and environmental. And Johan is having a quiet chuckle in the background, maybe not so quiet. Johan, people that do go out, do enjoy the outdoors, maybe fly fishermen. I can't think of anybody that really is not a candidate for your course.
What I find with the course is that I have very broad spectrum of people that attend, even housewives that are just worried about a snake in the garden.
Well, of course, if you would like to know more about it, we will give you the website details again. Get hold of Johan. Go on one of these courses. Put your mates together. If you're all going off to Botswana, safari, a whole bunch of you together, come along and get on the course. Get a better understanding of what you're going to be dealing with. Get hold of the books. Discover more about snake bites. Discover more about identifying the snakes. Interact with people like Johan as well, because I'm pretty sure that also through places like the ADU, you can submit a variety of the photographs you might take, and suddenly you may discover that snakes are not these great big nasty things to be feared, but yet again, simply part of our biodiversity and something there to be enjoyed and marveled at. And when we say that, we don't ask you to go out and pick the snake up and shake it. We just want you to watch it in its natural habitat. Johan, those website details, please.
The website is africansnakebiteinstitute.com. It's all one word. And if anyone struggles to get hold of that website, they can just Google my name, Johan Marais.
And of course, in Johan's website, you'll also discover that he provides all the equipment that one would need on a small holding or a lodge. And he will also, as we say, train you how to use it. And there is also things, if you are a mine, if you are a corporation who would like him to come along and not only talk to your folk, but maybe look at doing a survey or two around the mine, you'll discover a lot more about what lives there. Johan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, from Etam Neri, that's all we have time for this week's program. Yes, I am still busy editing out the program with Professor Mike Bruton, and you will remember that Mike was very involved in the coelacanth programs. And as he says, we'll never stop learning about that ancient fish that sends back so many millions of years. Mike also does some really great programs with kids, and I'm looking forward to finding out more about those in future programs. But of course, that world of conservation, I think we've got so much to learn. And will we ever finish our learning? I doubt it. Not in any lifetime whatsoever. Well, do remember that we are heading up to the silly season. So please make sure that your car is in good condition, well serviced, and your tyres are in wonderful state. And of course, always take care.
The Nature Journal supports the sustainability of our planet, its people and prosperity. Brought to you by SAPI, a leading global specialized cellulose, paper and packaging company. For more information, visit www.sappi.com. Sappi, inspired by life.